Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, a short week. And good morning, Amy. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. How are you, Tiger?
Oh, I'm good. All the better now. It's a short week for us.
Same.
Yeah. That long weekend was nice.
It was, especially the Cowboys win on the weekend.
Oh, wow. Wasn't that a game? Wasn't that a game?
I actually broke down in tears when Thurston missed that conversion. But lucky he came back. I think he was supposed to win.
Oh, so. Of course they were. They were meant to win. It was a big weekend of footy. You know, the Ipswich Jets have
Mom
been
and
in
Barber
the pomp.
Smashed it.
Hey?
Mom and Barber smashed it, didn't he?
I don't know. Yeah, might have. I don't know. But they won.
Yeah.
The Ipswich Jets won. They've been in the comp for 30 years. And this is the first time they've won. They had a black fella captain.
Yep.
Kieran Lander. The big game, the NRL game, the grand final.
Yep.
A black fella captain on each side. And then, of course, there was the Dubbo Koori knockout. Their 45th, I think it was, Koori knockout, annual Koori knockout. And that went down to the wire like the Broncos-Cowboys game. It went down to golden point, extra time. And the Redfern All Blacks took it out. And I was very happy to see that. I haven't been spent a lot of my time in Redfern.
I was happy too. It'll be exciting to have a knockout in Redfern instead of Newcastle. They had it in 3 years in a row, I think.
Yes.
It's nice to go to Sydney.
Yes.
Plus, the Redfern All Blacks have got an amazing history as well. So.
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, no, the Redfern All Blacks. And the Redfern All Blacks just won their local comp. They're the grand finalists in their local comp.
And also the women Redfern All Blacks won too.
Oh, well, they haven't
got to remember
beaten.
That.
I don't think they've
deadly.
Been beaten.
I wouldn't like to come up against them.
Oh, some big women, big hits out there with some big women. They can move. Yeah. So it was a good weekend of footy.
It was.
Yeah. If you're a mad rugby league nut. But haven't mentioned anything about the AFL because I'm not.
We don't
not
need
a,
to talk about that.
I'm not. Well, we're the official AFL station here, you know, so we should. But anyway, I don't watch it. But I see Hawthorn got up. So, yeah, that's all I know about the AFL. That's all I know.
I'm sorry, I can't add anything else. I don't know anything else about
terrible,
it.
Terrible. Blokes in here with the official AFL station. We've been broadcasting the AFL for 16 or 17 years. And I can't tell you any more than, yes, Hawthorn won. Our guest.
Yeah, so we've got a guest in the studio today. It's Amy McVie from McVie Law. And her background is in, she was previously Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women's Advocacy Service. Is that how you say it? Welcome to the program, Amy.
Yeah, thanks very much, Amy, and thanks, Tiger, for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into law, particularly working at the Aboriginal Women's Advocacy Service?
Yeah, sure. So I studied law in Canberra and then moved to Queensland soon after that and did some years working in private practice. And during that time I did a fair bit of volunteering and particularly here in West End actually at the Homeless Persons Legal Clinic and came into contact with lots of Aboriginal people living on the streets that needed legal services. And just, I guess, really enjoyed those interactions. And then I went overseas to the Philippines and did some work with a community legal organisation there. And I just didn't want to return to private practice. I just seen the amazing things you could do as a lawyer that were a bit different than sort of sitting in a high-rise in the middle of the city. And I came back, I got this great job in the Northern Territory based there in Katherine and did lots of work into really remote communities like Lajamanu and Nuka, places like that, Borroloola, and worked with Aboriginal women. And that was just, you know, blow your mind kind of stuff. Beautiful country, beautiful women, amazing art, life-changing kind of experience and also heartbreaking. You know, I saw some shocking living conditions. I saw people in a lot of pain and I thought that our government could do more. And it was at the time that the Northern Territory intervention happened, so bucket loads of money were being poured in. But what I saw was lots of white bureaucrats flying into these communities, getting paid absolutely outrageous salaries to do community development work that the community themselves could have been empowered to do.
Did you ever see any, I mean, when they talk about the intervention, they talk about it being for the benefit of Aboriginal women and children.
Yeah.
Did you see that money, I mean, you already said it went mostly to white bureaucrats, but was there any change for the situation of Aboriginal women from your view?
I think that to be fair, that there was. For example, my position was through funding that a women's legal service received as a result of the intervention. So perhaps more services were going in to help women and children. But I guess what I really felt critical of is the way that things were being delivered. It wasn't that it was what the community was asking for. It was more what the government thought that the community needed. And also just some pretty demoralising things, like when you're driving into community and you see the big signs saying, you know, no pornography here, no alcohol here, all of these sorts of things that give messages about the type of people that must live in these communities, which is totally wrong and incorrect. Yeah.
And coming from Goulburn and coming from a completely different society, looking at the Northern Territory and then your work in Queensland, how shocking was it for you to realise that, you know, human rights obviously doesn't extend to all in Australia?
I used to have this funny experience. So this is when I was at the Aboriginal Women's Legal Service in Woolloongabba, and I always used to have this funny experience because I'd be working with these passionate Aboriginal women and we'd be looking at really shocking human rights issues, you know, and particularly advocating for women in relation to child protection matters and family violence and that sort of thing. And then I'd get in my car and I'd drive back over to my suburb of Redhill where, you know, it's all white picket fences, and it was like moving between two realities at times, but so important to have that awareness. And I guess once your eyes are open, they can't ever be closed again.
And we're talking today specifically about a Human Rights Act in Queensland. Can you tell us a little bit of a history? I mean, when I think of Queensland and our history, I think of Jerry Balke Peterson, and I actually think of human rights abuses being synonymous with Queensland. I think a lot of people think we're really backward. Has there ever been this concerted push for a Human Rights Act, or why now in the current environment?
Yeah. So I think you're right that there's some big political influences there. And I know that you read an article that I recently wrote in the Brisbane Times. And in that article, I was trying to make the point that, sure, politically now is the time for a Human Rights Act for Queensland, but actually every day is the time for a Human Rights Act throughout Australia, because there are people interacting with government agencies who every day are not having their human rights considered or protected in those interactions. But yeah, as you say, I think Queenslanders have a pretty heightened sense of what's possible with a government that doesn't act within the confines of what we would expect of government power, executive power. And we certainly have seen some recent examples of government passing laws that affect all of our civil and political rights, our right to freedom of expression, our right to freedom of association, freedom of movement. These sort of things have all been recently challenged, you know, in the middle of the night with no consultation with the community. And that's the sort of thing that a Human Rights Act would change, not necessarily the outcome of an act, but certainly human rights implications would need to be considered when we're considering new laws. And certainly the community needs to know, hey, we're going to pass a law that's going to restrict your right to enjoy freedom of expression, for example.
And we're talking predominantly about the Newman government, aren't we, where we saw the need for this sort of instrument to be put in place in Queensland, particularly because we don't have an upper house or any sort of mechanism to protect that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a Human Rights Act is essential for all governments, whether they're an ALP government or an LNP government or any type of government. A Human Rights Act provides us as citizens with a safety net to know that no matter what government's in at the moment, our human rights are going to be protected.
I'm just wondering why governments would want to respond and put in place the Human Rights Act if they are able to so readily abuse rights. They don't have any oversight or anything like that. I mean, do you find that governments are sort of antagonistic towards wanting to put these sort of instruments in place?
I guess at the end of the day, governments are supposed to respond to what we as society societies hold important to us. And certainly our governments have, on an international level, told the world that, Australia cares about human rights. We've signed up to all the major human rights treaties, and part of the obligation there is to go home and enact legislation which gives citizens the ability to enforce their rights. So our government certainly has made that commitment. Also, you can see in the Labor Party's policy platform, both federally and in Queensland, that there is a commitment to human rights and a commitment to legislation that protects human rights. And so I think it's a smart thing to do. I think a government that introduces a Human Rights Act is saying we care about people, we care about being accountable, and we care about being transparent.
And when we talk about human rights in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Queensland, what rights are you talking about that could potentially be protected under a wide-ranging Human Rights Act?
Yeah, that is such a good question, Amy, and I think it's really, really important for Aboriginal people in Queensland to have a long, hard think about that. And next year, hopefully, we'll have a parliamentary inquiry in relation to a Human Rights Act for Queensland and what that act should include. And I think it's a really important opportunity for Aboriginal people to say these are our particular rights, and these are things that we want protected. But in other jurisdictions, there's some clear examples of specific human rights protections for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So, for example, in the ACT Human Rights Act, the preamble includes a statement that says that human rights have special significance for Indigenous people as the first owners of the land, members of its most enduring cultures, and individuals for whom the issue of human rights protection has great and continuing importance. Then even probably more powerfully, the Victorian Charter includes a similar statement in the preamble, but also includes a standalone right protecting the unique cultural rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And so it actually says that Aboriginal persons hold distinct cultural rights and must be not denied this right with other members of their community to enjoy their identity and culture and to maintain and use their language, to maintain their kinship ties, to maintain their distinctive spiritual, material and economic relationship with the land and waters and other resources, which they have a connection under traditional law and customs. Now, can you think of anywhere else in the law in Australia where you have an enforceable right that says things like that? And we have an historic opportunity here in Queensland for that type of thing to be protected. And I would say to go further. So the Victorian Charter was recently reviewed. It's been in operation for 8 years, and about 2 weeks ago a report came down making recommendations not to get rid of the Act but to strengthen it and improve it. And one of the key recommendations for Aboriginal people is that the recommendation that the right to self-determination be included in the Victorian Charter. That's a big thing. And we've got an opportunity here in Queensland to say, let's not start with the softly, softly approach. Let's go boots first and ask for self-determination, ask for Aboriginal people's cultural rights to be protected. Now, to begin with, in the legislation, that's just a statement, right? It's a statement of our values and what we hold to be, you know, true for us. But down the track, what it means is that legislation that's passed has to consider then Aboriginal people's right to their culture and right to self-determination. It means that governments, when they're developing policies, have to consider Aboriginal people's right to self-determination and right to their culture. And so it means that, say, for example, a woman is interacting with child protection services, her child's being removed, child safety is showing no regard for that child or that child's right to culture, that actually her advocate is able to say, hang on here, in court, the department needs to be held to account. How are they going to demonstrate that their actions actually protect the right of this child to their culture?
Has that ever been used in Victoria as a defence in the courts?
So in child protection child protection cases, the rights that have been used are probably more like the right to equality before the law, which is another right that's protected in the Charter, and also the right to family. And so a case that, you know, is similar to... So I guess in my experience as a lawyer acting for Aboriginal women coming into contact with child protection, one of the things that I noticed was that child safety wasn't really willing to come to the table to give women the support that they needed to be the mothers that they wanted to be. And so although this case I'm going to mention in Victoria doesn't involve an Aboriginal woman, it involves, again, a situation where child safety in Victoria wasn't giving the woman the services that she needed to be the woman that, to be the mother that she wanted to be. And so the mother in this case had cerebral palsy, and child safety were removing her child because of an assumption that a woman with disability cannot look after a child. Her advocates, her lawyers, were able to use the right to family and the right to equality before the law to resist that intervention.
And that was in the Human Rights Act, was it?
That's exactly right. Okay, that's exactly right. And to say, actually, your obligation is to support this woman, not to take this kid away.
Wow.
And so that actually stopped child safety's intervention, and they have no longer been involved in that family.
Wow, so they used the Human Rights Act to stop the removal of a child in court.
Exactly.
And you've had situations in Queensland, haven't you, where you've had cases where child safety were going to take a child away, particularly from an Aboriginal woman, and you had no avenue to go down to actually protest that in court or raise it as a defence?
That's right, yeah. So, I've seen lots of examples of that, and I think that the thing about a Human Rights Act is that it might not even get to court, you know, if you can raise those enforceable rights before you get there, because, you know, my experience in other jurisdictions is that often, and in child protection as well, that often you can resolve issues without going to court if you're able to demonstrate a clear, strong legal argument.
Is Victoria the only state with legislation?
And the ACT.
Rights? And the ACT, they have human rights legislation.
That's right.
Now, look, past governments, federal government particularly, they don't have a good track record regarding human rights. Look at the way they've got children behind razor wire. The horrific situation on Nauru and other places where they're holding people, the rapes and things that have taken place. But... my point is the federal government, Howard in particular, thumbed his nose at human rights law and Australia's obligations.
And
international obligations. James Anaya, the special rapporteur, came out here on more than one occasion, wrote more than one report, particularly about the intervention, claimed it was discriminatory and it wasn't right. So my point is they don't have a good track record regarding human rights. How can people get – or what's going to change? How can people get excited about this proposal? Why should they get excited about this?
Yeah. I think it's something that's hard – it's a question that's hard to answer. I think on a national level, you know, we had the 2009 – so we had the 2009 national consultation about whether we needed a National Human Rights Act. And the consultation team travelled all around Australia, including throughout Queensland, and overwhelmingly Australians said, we want human rights protections, we want a Human Rights Act. And that report came down with a recommendation that the Rudd government introduce a Human Rights Act. Why he stalled, I can't answer that question. But I do think here in Queensland we've got a different kind of opportunity in that... this was something that came about because of our independent speaker, Wellington, in the last year. He made comments about the need for a Human Rights Act to protect us from all governments as Queenslanders. And the Labor Party made a commitment when they formed government, when Wellington supported him, to look at the issue. So there's some government, you know, there's certainly some support within government for this. And then we've had the commitment to... we had a campaign launch for... we've been campaigning for this for a little while behind the scenes. We had a campaign launch on the 14th of September, and at the time the Attorney-General made the announcement that we will have a parliamentary inquiry into the issue. So what we have here is an opportunity to show this government that tells us that they're all about consultation, that they're all about responding to what the people of Queensland are telling them. We have an opportunity through a parliamentary inquiry to tell the government that we are supportive of the introduction of a Human Rights Act, that there are existing human rights issues in Queensland, and that a Human Rights Act has human rights legislation in other jurisdictions have demonstrated that this type of legislation does create cultural change and does have outcomes for individuals in terms of their human rights protection.
Right.
When you talk about the right to culture and being able to push for that in a Human Rights Act, how would that go up against existing legislations like land rights law and cultural heritage in Queensland? Would that bolster it, or does it conflict, or how does that work?
So the way that the Act works is basically, and I guess probably the most relevant part for your question is about what the Act requires public authorities to do. And so it requires public authorities, which is government departments and any agency delivering public services, to consider human rights in their actions and in their decisions. So it's sort of an overlaying framework for things. It certainly doesn't change existing laws. It's an overarching framework for the development of new laws, for the delivery of services, and for decision making. There will be situations, I guess, where the court will be required to consider whether, because the court's obligation under a Human Rights Act is to try and interpret legislation consistently with human rights where possible. And there's going to be examples where they're going to have to say, well, there's no way we can interpret this legislation consistently with human rights. In that case, they would issue a declaration of incompatibility, which would then go back to the parliament. It doesn't actually stop the law from working. What it does do is it gives us a red flag, hey, this law is inconsistent with human rights, and it asks the parliament to have a look at it.
It gives you sort of a defence or a way to sort of defend different legislation or just gives you, something to defend against, I guess.
And a way to scrutinise legislation. Yeah. So I guess a way to think about it is like two things. It's a fairness radar. So it's a way for us to understand fairness and a way for us to test things for their fairness. And also it's a safety net.
Yeah. Because federal parliament does have a human rights scrutiny committee, and occasionally they just don't put in legislation. They don't pass it through, you know. I mean, when you talk about federal governments particularly not respecting human rights, I mean, it just seems like they can just cherry pick what they want to send to that scrutiny committee. Is that going to be a problem or...?
So that's a good point. That legislation that exists at a Commonwealth level was sort of like your runner-up prize or something out of the Rudd Inquiry, the Brennan Inquiry, which happened under the Rudd government. So
which was the Human Rights Act, the National Human Rights Act.
Yeah, so the recommendation was let's pass a full Human Rights Act, and the consolation prize was, okay, we're going to pass this Parliamentary Scrutiny Act, which basically requires... all pieces of legislation to be referred to Human Rights Committee for scrutiny to see if they comply with human rights. And, there has been some good outcomes through that process, but also I think it's open to abuse of power again, because things can still get rushed through without proper scrutiny, and it does depend on who is sitting on the committee as well.
Let's take a break for a song. I want to come back and ask, as far as international law goes, we've got the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Mm. And there's an opportunity for domestic law to be able to embrace that and legislate under the umbrella of that, if you can understand what I'm saying. I want to talk about that, raise that.
Sure.
Because there's another framework of international law regarding rights, that we have an opportunity to make some changes, legislative changes in this country, under the umbrella of that United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So let's talk about that straight after this break. Our guest, Amy McVie, a human rights lawyer, talking about human rights. Titters, share a dream. And yes, this could very well be a dream, but let's hope it's... Amy McVee is our guest, and maybe it's more than a dream here, Amy, eh?
I think so.
Yeah? Become a reality?
Yep, wake up in our dreams.
So tell us, in reference to or regarding the international, the human rights charter for the rights of Indigenous people, how can this... Well, we're talking about similar sort of thing here, are we not? We're talking about
the
rights.
The UN Declaration, yeah.
The UN Declaration, domestic law, protection of rights. There doesn't seem to be... There seems to be some hesitancy in actually taking that step further than just being a signatory to these declarations. Yeah. I mean, Australia... And now they want to get on the Security Council. I mean, look
human
at that.
Human Rights Council,
human
yeah.
Rights, human Rights Council. Well, my goodness me.
Well, that's the thing I found amazing about the Howard government, and particularly Mel Brough was making this argument. They didn't want to ratify the UN Declaration, or they didn't want to sign the UN Declaration because it had clauses about self-determination and yeah. rights to self-determination. But the Declaration is basically, I mean, unless they legislate for it, you know, government, it's not legally binding, is it?
Mm.
So... I mean, how does that work with the Human Rights Act in Queensland?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing to say is that, okay, there's a number of things to say. One is that when governments sign up to those treaties, they are agreeing to take that those obligations home and to protect them domestically, and a key element of that protection is enacting legislation. So the examples of legislation in the ACT and Victoria and the Commonwealth Act that you talked about before, Amy, they're all examples of bringing international law home. And so the examples in Victoria and the ACT provide domestic protection of the rights contained in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and some small examples of protection of our economic and social rights. Like in ACT, there's the right to education protected. And as I said before, Indigenous people's right to their culture is protected in the Victorian Charter. Interestingly, the Commonwealth Act goes further. So it defines human rights by looking at all the rights contained in all the treaties that were a signatory to.
So when you're talking about the Act, that's the one that never got up, is
no,
it?
No, this is the Act that did get up, that parliamentary scrutiny one that we just talked before.
Yeah.
So it actually refers to all the treaties that were a signatory to. But when you talk about the Declaration, the difference there is that the Declaration isn't a treaty, okay? So it's supposed to be, rather than being a binding instrument of international law, which is what the human rights treaties are, the Declaration is supposed to be an aspirational statement of rights. But don't get stuck on that, because really what it is, it's an interpretation of existing binding laws interpreted looking specifically at Indigenous people from around the world. So certainly, although you might not be able to say that all of the rights contained in the Declaration are binding as a matter of international law, they all derive from binding international treaties. The other thing is that at an international level, the human rights is not just protected through treaties, it's protected through customary law. And there's a big argument that's put forward, and James Anaya that you mentioned before, Tiger, is one of the sort of pushes of this argument, that the Declaration actually forms customary international law and in that sense is binding.
So what does customary international law actually
mean? So you've got to think about it like, you know, domestically we've got common law and legislation. So legislation's the stuff that's written down in the documents that's passed by Parliament. Common law is the stuff that judges develop through their decisions. Same sort of on an international level.
Okay.
Customary law would be like your equivalent of common law, but on an international level. And it's pretty technical how that customary law actually evolves, but that's basically what I mean by that. But we do have this opportunity here in Queensland, because I think the Declaration is this really important statement of how human rights should be particularly interpreted to benefit Indigenous people of the world. And the Declaration has been embraced by Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people and has been used by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to interrogate and to understand different laws and policies, and to highlight and to illustrate to the world where our government falls down on the protection of human rights for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So it's an important statement, and it's a statement that's been embraced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So I think then we go, well, what can we do about this in terms of in actually making this something that's enforceable domestically? And so I go back to what I said before about how the ACT and Victorian model are bringing those international treaties home. I think that in Queensland, we actually have an opportunity to bring some of the declaration home through this parliamentary inquiry to say these are the rights that should be included. And you know that right of self-determination, which is the sort of central theme of the declaration, that's what they're saying should be included in the Victorian Charter.
Wow.
Okay, so that's what recommendation's being made, that there is a clear case, and this is an independent report done about how we should strengthen the Charter in Victoria, and they're saying one thing that should happen is that the right to self-determination should be included in the preamble, but also should be included as a stand-alone enforceable right. So self-determination includes that stuff about free, prior and informed consent, you know. And once you start to think about that being applied to laws, government policies and decision-making in courts, I mean, it blows your mind, the potential.
It does.
Yeah.
It is mind-blowing stuff.
I'm wondering what both of you think, there probably is an international definition for it, but what do we mean when we say self-determination? Because I think there's all those arguments, especially in Aboriginal communities as well, about self-determination and sovereignty. I'm just wondering, from an international perspective, is there an actual definition of what self-determination actually means? And maybe does it work with maybe what the Queensland Blackfellow community want?
Yeah. Look, I think it's a really, really slippery term to define, but there is definitely international law around the meaning of self-determination. I think when it comes to sort of the context of Indigenous people's self-determination, it shouldn't be confused necessarily with sovereignty, because it's more about existing within the existing nation state, but being able to determine how things apply to Indigenous people. So it includes things like being able to have representative bodies who are chosen by local people to have a voice in the development of laws and policies, and really that Aboriginal people themselves are determining how things work. So when I think about self-determination, for example, in relation to child protection, it would be things like involving Aboriginal people in decision-making.
Yep.
That relates not just to the development of laws and policies, but the individual removals of children and the stuff about recognised entities, for example, that you've got that come in supposed to represent the best interests of Indigenous kids. Well, I would say that self-determination would mean that those recognised entities actually have a decision-making role in child protection, that you actually have a body that's representing Indigenous people that are advising the government.
The removal authorities.
Exactly.
Because it doesn't really work like that at the moment in relation to child removal. We have advocacy bodies like SNAKE, obviously, ABSEC down in New South Wales, but it doesn't work like that. We have no avenue to sort of protest that or have a voice in that.
Yeah, no. My experience with child protection, when you have your recognised entities who actually are able to make submissions in court, but they're not actually allowed to say they're not actually able to be a party to the proceedings, and they're pretty hamstrung in relation to how they can participate in the proceedings. They're not actually able to gather their evidence independently and form their own independent view. They're sort of just given information by the department, and I didn't see examples of recognised entities not supporting the government's position. I guess that's because they weren't being given
full
information or resources or the right to self-determination hadn't been applied. It was more like the government saying, this is the way that we're going to hear from Aboriginal people in this context. This is how we're going to resource you. This is how you're going to do things, rather than going, okay, we're going to work with Aboriginal people to say, how can we involve you?
Because, that's a really interesting point, because I think some, even when you talk about being able to control your own affairs, it's always within. And we had Gregory Phillips rerun yesterday, and I was listening to Let's Talk, and he was talking about how even Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations aren't independent. They're not, you know, they don't have really true self-determination because they're all existing in this white structure, and they've got to apply for white funding, and they've got to abide by white ways.
So do it on white terms.
Especially in Queensland, we've never had true self-determination, have we? I mean,
no.
I don't think anywhere in the country true self-determination is.
Even if they say that, you know.
But it's not protected anywhere in legislation.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's what I'm saying here is in Victoria, that recommendation is really exciting to me because if the government takes it up and amends the charter to include a right to self-determination, you know, that will be the first time that I know of that Australia has recognised in legislation that Aboriginal people, Torres Strait Islander people, have the right to self-determination. And I guess that's what I'm saying, like, we need to hear these lessons from down south where these things have already been in operation for, you know, ACT over 10 years, Victoria, you know, 8 years, learn from their lessons, and we can start actually from, you know, from where they are now rather than...
Yeah, not behind the eight ball.
That's right,
We have two Aboriginal members of parliament in Queensland. Is this something that they could potentially take up, or have they been interested in pushing this right, Leanne Enoch and Billy Gordon?
Yeah. I mean, love them to take it up and push it through. Leanne definitely is aware of our campaign. Was actually going to be involved in our campaign launch, but that fell through at the last minute, and that was no fault of hers. It was, you know, conflicting obligations. So Leanne definitely knows about it, and, you know, we'd love to hear from Billy as well.
So where is the campaign at the moment? Are you looking at getting a whole heap of groups together to come up with some sort of uniform set of rights that you might want in a Human Rights Act, or is it just sort of just like everyone has a go?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do is coordinate a campaign which is a broad coalition of organisations from all around the state and representing all different groups. So we do have, for example, ATSL's Aboriginal Legal Service involved, lots of other groups involved, women's groups, people that represent people with disabilities themselves. We've got a big coalition of organisations. And really what we're looking at is saying we, as a broad group, support the introduction of a Human Rights Act for Queensland. We want the government to refer the issue to a parliamentary inquiry. That was our first message. The government listened. The government is referring it to a parliamentary inquiry. Our next thing is refer it now. Let's have a referral this year. Let's have an inquiry in the first half of next year. Let's make sure the inquiry is about open community consultation and that as many Queenslanders as possible, you know, give the parliamentary committee their views on what should be included. And interestingly, when we had the national consultation under Rudd, I read in the report, one of the things they said was that they didn't hear a lot from Aboriginal people about the rights they wanted included. They didn't hear the specifics from Aboriginal people. And so I would encourage Aboriginal people to really think about that, think about what would be the best things to be included. And I think the go-to place is the Declaration for sure, you know, because they have a ready-made statement of the relevant rights for Indigenous peoples. And so we want a consultation in the first half of next year that hears from people all over Queensland from a diverse range of views. It's our hope then that the committee will bring down a report in the middle of next year that will recommend the introduction of an act, and that our government will hear that and enact legislation by the end of next year. So this broad coalition of organisations doesn't have to have consensus on what rights should be included. Really what we're saying is we want a legislative model of human rights. And when I say that, what I mean is in some jurisdictions like the US, they have, and Canada, they have constitutionally entrenched bills of rights. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the legislative models, and they exist in the UK, in New Zealand, in the ACT and in Victoria. That's the type of legislation we want. It's called a dialogue model. It requires the government to consider human rights in all its actions. And then we think that the community needs to be consulted on what rights should be included.
It seems like a lot. I mean, when we always talk about constitutional reform, and it's such a heated issue and really divisive issue amongst black communities, to me it seems just like a pipe dream, actually getting proper constitutional protection in the constitution. This actually seems like something that is achievable, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's achievable. I mean, we had the Labor Party conference change their party platform a few weeks, 6 weeks or so ago, to say they have a commitment to introducing a Human Rights Act. An urgency motion was passed unopposed that the inquiry be held. 2 weeks after that, we have our launch. The Attorney General and the Deputy Premier came and spoke and affirmed their commitment to human rights and to holding a parliamentary inquiry. And so we got some runs on the board, and we just need to, as the Deputy Premier said at our launch, not take our feet off the pedal.
Mm. What could we say to a lot of our sort of listeners who may not have their rights violated on a daily basis? I mean, when we're talking about a Human Rights Act, a lot of the time it is the most vulnerable we're talking about, but how can we make it such an urgent issue and even a political issue for people who may not be as vulnerable to rights abuses as obviously blackfellas or people with disabilities or people who are, very vulnerable to being homeless, for example?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question, because when people think about human rights, it is often that they're thinking about it as a reactive measure, so something that fixes problems when they've already happened. And those vulnerable groups that you've mentioned are more likely to have to suffer human rights abuses. But I think that we're all pretty appalled when our government comes in and passes legislation that affect us all, and we realise, hey, hang on a minute, we wouldn't have much power to stop you from doing that, other than waiting until the next election and voting you out. And so the thing about this is that it is actually about all of us. It's like it's a safety net for all of us to know that whoever's in Parliament is bound by this set of obligations. And really what human rights are is a statement of our values. And I think that the fair go for Australia is, that does reflect our values, and that's what human rights are about. And so I think it's not just about vulnerable people, it's about all of us getting a bit of power back in our hands and saying, you actually, as a government, have to consider our rights all along the way, right? And if you don't, we actually have the ability to hold you accountable.
Yeah. It gives people a way to articulate it too, because I don't think a lot of people actually understand when their rights are being violated.
Yeah.
Especially with the media we have. I mean, we're not told the true story half the time. So, I mean, there's even that sense that how do you even articulate that? How do you even know if what the government's doing is right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And I think that that's a good point to raise too, because if you've got a Human Rights Act, and this is true of all law, a standalone piece of legislation isn't going to change everything. You're going to have some other measures alongside it to change the culture and to get people to understand. So I think if we had legislation, we'd also have to have pretty good community education explaining to people what this means for them. And like that, I gave that example of the Victorian Charter, including the cultural rights for Indigenous people. The commentary I've read around that is actually that it's been underutilised. And so the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission have actually said that they're about to start a community education program to work with the Aboriginal community to help them to understand what that right means and how they should enforce it.
Yep.
Because if something's just existing but no one actually knows it's there and no one knows how to use it, it's not going to be much good. So it is important that we have those education campaigns as well.
It'd be pretty amazing if Queensland actually got a Human Rights Act. When you think of Queensland, exactly, you think of it as such a backward state. Uh-huh. I know it's my home state, but it would be amazing if we were only one of three in the country to have that legislation.
Oh, I think that's actually a reason why it's something that kind of a lot of Queenslanders support, because they have had that experience of what happens when, of the lack of accountability for government. I think that, you know, we've actually got an opportunity here to be up the front with human rights protection. So, sure, we might not have been the first state to pass it, but I think that we should be asking for something even better than what exists in the ACT in Victoria. And particularly as it relates to Aboriginal people, I think, you know, it's a great opportunity for some really good organised advocacy around incorporating key aspects of the Declaration into a binding Human Rights Act here in Queensland.
The community engagement that will take place. You mentioned earlier the fact that not a lot of First Nations people engage and stuff. That's a common thing that's happened in these situations, and it's about designing it and having First Nations people included and be in front and centre sort of thing, you know. It's about the design of the engagement and stuff. It's going to see a more meaningful engagement and responses from our mob.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not ones for writing. It's very difficult to be putting this up on paper, for example. So it'll be interesting to see how that's worked out. But that's an important part of it all, is that?
It is, Tiger, and I think that's the kind of advocacy that needs to be happening right now. They're the messages that we need to get into the government's ears right now as they develop the terms of reference and the style of the consultation, is that we need to be saying to them, how are you going to engage properly, particularly with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? Mm. How are you going to hear their views on this? Because it's a key component of developing this type of legislation, and it's a key kind of message this government has given us, that they are all about consultation.
Yep. And an inquiry, it'd have to leave Brisbane, wouldn't it? You're hoping that it'll go all around the state?
We don't know if it'll leave Brisbane, so it looks likely to be referred to, I think it's called the Legal and Community Affairs Committee, and they get referrals of lots of different pieces of legislation that they have, you know, they're hugely, especially at the moment, there's lots of legislative reform going on. So, you know, what is their capacity going to be? What resources are they going to have? Are they going to travel? What are they going to be asked to do? These are things that we want to know about and we want some input into.
And where can our mob find more information about this? I mean, I've seen a bit of media around it, but
yeah,
it'd be good if a lot of blackfellas out there knew where to actually access it.
Yeah. And so we've got a website.
Yep.
And do you want me to tell you what that
is?
Yes,
yeah. We'll put it up on our Facebook page too.
Yeah, so it's www.humanrights4, as in the number 4, qld.com.au. And on there you'll see we've got a link to our Facebook page, Instagram and Twitter account.
Yeah, yeah. That's so great to hear.
There's been actually a decent amount of media and we've got a lot of information on our Facebook page and, you know, our website's just new, so we're still uploading stuff to that. But hoping to be, especially during the consultation, really hoping to be able to provide the community with resources to help them to inform their submissions and the feedback that they're giving to government.
Yeah. What would you say to the question, well, why should mainstream Queenslanders, dominant culture mob, why should they, what's it mean to them, why should they get behind this? Is it not just something for blacks or for asylum seekers or for other minority groups? How do you answer that?
Well, I think the thing that I say, and I sort of said this before, is that it's two things. It's a fairness radar and it's a safety net. So one, I think all of us, from whatever walk of life, want to know that our government's accountable. And that's what I mean by fairness radar. A Human Rights Act applies a fairness radar to all of government actions. And I think that's important for all people. But also it's a safety net. And so you know how they describe the National Disability Insurance Scheme as a safety net, saying we might not all have disability, but we're all paying for this scheme because it's an insurance scheme. If we acquire disability, we know that there's a safety net there to catch us.
Yeah.
A Human Rights Act is a bit like that too, because it says we might not all feel vulnerable to human rights abuses, but should we become vulnerable, and I can say that most of us at times would be vulnerable, all Australians, you know, it crosses all economic and social groups, issues like violence against women, issues like mental health, disability, ageing, all of these things make us all vulnerable. and knowing that if we do become vulnerable, there's a safety net there that we know that our human rights are going to be considered in actions that are affecting us.
Sounds like we've got to drum up some grassroots support as well, let of our mob know, because it seems like a really good opportunity, particularly in Queensland, just to have that safety net, I think. I think it's an excellent opportunity.
For sure. Something we've got to get behind. Any last questions?
I just actually wanted to ask really quickly, Australia, internationally, where do other Western countries sit on having Human Rights Act? Are we sort of in a very unique situation?
Completely unique is the exact right word. So every other democracy in the world has human rights legislation.
Yeah, except us. We're the only one.
Yeah.
And we're the only one without a treaty.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to do it. We gotta get it right in Queensland, I reckon. And we're the only Western country to never sign treaties or anything like that. So we're very far behind, you know. So
Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your
time.
Thanks both. It's good. Very good. Amy McVee. I knew I'd say the wrong one just sooner or later. I said your name right enough time. And that's it. We'll take a break for a short message here and back with news.
Type 2 diabetes is common amongst our mob. While it's often passed down through our genes, the condition can also be brought on from eating too much processed food and not doing enough physical activity. Sometimes we don't even know we're developing diabetes because we think symptoms like blurry vision, going to the toilet a lot, and feeling tired all the time are a part of getting older. If you already know you have type 2 diabetes, taking care of yourself through eating well, being active, and regular health checks are important, as is talking to your family about how you manage your condition so they can support you. For more advice on how to manage your diabetes, visit your local health service or give the Diabetes Queensland Helpline a call on 1300 136 588. Sponsored by the Australian Government through the National Diabetes Services Scheme. Station sponsor.
Yes, that's certainly an interesting discussion about the Human Rights Act for Queensland. You've got to get behind it. We'll be talking more about it, Amy, promoting it where we can and putting stuff up there in people's faces or in people's ears.
Most definitely. Yeah. And you can check it out on our Facebook page too. So if you Google Facebook Let's Talk 98.9, I'll put all the links up there so you can check it out as well. And tomorrow we're talking about stolen wages in Western Australia with a professor over there who's going to give us a personal account, but also what's currently happening in Western Australia, which will have similarities to Queensland as well.
Very good. Task force. Very good. Join us tomorrow on your local First Nation station for Let's Talk.